Call a meeting to order. Thank you all for coming. First up, we have approval of the minutes. Representative Sanders is nice enough to move the minutes of the 2:16:10 meeting. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion passes. First up today, we've got reconsideration of Senate File 1778. This bill we actually heard last week, but we didn't actually have it in the possession of the committee. This is the one that memorializes our desire to have the federal government stay out of the regulation of insurance here in Minnesota. It passed on a unanimous voice ballot or voice vote out of our committee, but it wasn't actually in the possession of our committee. So we just got to move to reconsider that take it up, and then we'll recommend it to pass to the General Register. Chair, I'll move that Senate File 1778 be reconsidered. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, motion carries. Chair, I'll move that Senate File 1778 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion carries. First up today, we have House File 2613, Representative Hillstrom's bill. Representative Hillstrom has the joy today of taking the bar exam. So Representative Dabney is going to pinch hit. It's my understanding that he was given the choice of taking the bar exam, but opted to be here and present the bill instead. So the Representative Dabney, it's my understanding that this came through the division. So Representative Dabney will move the division report. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Dabney then moves House File 2613 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Chair and members, House File 2613 should look pretty familiar to members because you voted on this bill in this committee last year and on the House floor. It changed meaningfully from this committee to the House floor. The bill that is before you today is the bill that you voted on the House floor. The difference is it deals with the current foreclosure crisis and creating a place for homeowners and lenders to be able to sit down together, metaphorically, because it allows them to do it by telephone, and see if there is a reasonable avenue to modify that loan in a way that's agreeable to both parties with the assistance of a mediator and save that home. There's a recognition that, needless to say, it's not a 100% successful process. But with the complaints many of us have gotten from constituents, heard in the media, of the difficulty of accessing consistently the opportunities that are out there today, many complaints from consumers that I sent the bank my information, now they can't find it, I sent it again, they said they didn't receive it. This creates a forum where people can work together. The differences in this bill today from when this committee voted on it last year is it now does not, and I repeat, not increase the foreclosure timeline here in Minnesota. It now exempts banks and other lenders with five or fewer foreclosures in the previous 12 months. Borrowers are required to undergo foreclosure prevention counseling before being eligible for the mediation. It provides, as I said, for telephonic mediations. The initial meeting must be conducted by phone. Subsequent meetings conducted by phone unless the mediator certifies that personal attendance is necessary. It has bad faith penalties for both the creditor and the debtor. For the creditor, bad faith, the foreclosure continues with the normal six-month redemption period. The debtor, bad faith, is a deed in lieu of foreclosure required within 90 days. Mediation under this is funded by a $125 fee paid with the foreclosure filing. As I said, you saw it last year in an earlier form in this committee, last year on the House floor in this form. With me today is Mr. Fricke, Assistant Attorney General, who is here for questions if need be.
Thank you, Representative Dabney, and that brings me to the point. This is the first bill that we've had this session come out of division. As is the course in this committee, we give great deference to our division recommendations. So to the extent that folks have testimony to provide, it would be best that it be abbreviated in nature. Mr. Fricke, do you have anything that you care to add to Representative Dabney? It sounds like you're the chief author of this bill. As well as you presented, you Nobody tell Representative Hillstrom that. We don't want to make her feel bad. But
Mr. Chair, in the interest of brevity, the credit unions are not going to testify. There's no shorter testimony than none whatsoever, except members will find in their packets a letter now in support of this legislation. I believe it's accurate to say that last year they were neutral on the bill. This year they are now in support. So you do see the financial industry shifting some of their positions.
We saw that. Thank you, Representative Dabney. Mr. Fichte, any other comments?
I have nothing, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Then we've got Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so the 125 for filing the foreclosure, is that for filing the Liz Pendens then, or what is it for?
Mr. Fichte?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, that's for filing either the notice of pendency or the notice of Liz Pendens. That is correct.
Okay.
Representative Dabney, that was one of the bar exam questions that you could have done today. Anything else, Representative Mueller?
Just, Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to make sure that we got all the changes. What did you? I didn't catch what you did with counselors.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, the borrower is required to go through foreclosure prevention counseling in order to be eligible for mediation. This is the exact same bill in the form that was voted on the House floor last May, I believe.
Okay, so that's not a change.
It is not a change. These are simply changes from the last time the bill was heard by this committee.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Great. Any other questions for Mr. Fichte at this time? Otherwise, we do have two people who signed up to testify, Mr. Johnson and Mrs. Gilbred. Mr. Johnson, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Steve Johnson. I'm Director of Government Relations at the Minnesota Bankers Association. And just to note that the MBA represents approximately 94% of the banks in Minnesota today, large and small, all across the state, and most, if not all, the banks in your districts. And just a couple of real quick points. The traditional banks I represent have been in the Minnesota communities for nearly 106 years, and just for trivia, and I apologize, some of you have heard this already from the division, that First Bank was chartered in Minnesota in 1856, Root River State Bank in Chatfield, and it's still there today. So it's been there through good times and bad, through all the economic cycles.
Representative Davids was actually there for the ribbon cutting.
Do they have the sheet music?
They do have the sheet music. Excuse me.
I'm sorry. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My members are employers. They employ approximately 50,000 people across the state. They're civic-minded community business leaders. They're active in their communities. They're the economic engines of their community. We want to commend Representative Hillstrom, the Attorney General, Representative Dabney, and others for working on foreclosure issues. And together, all of us have worked on several pieces of legislation over the last years. In fact, my count is that we've had 22 laws passed by the legislature the last 3 years on predatory lending and foreclosures, with nearly 70 provisions in those pieces of legislation. Oh, Chairman Mullery, too, has also been very active in that. I just wanted to mention that. However, the legislation that's before you today, we do not support. And I want to make it clear that my members share the concerns of policymakers in regard to the high levels of foreclosures in Minnesota. Foreclosures are lenders' last resort. A traditional bank's goal is to provide all of the customer services, financial services, and needs throughout their lifetimes, their savings accounts, their checking accounts, CDs, loans, and other services. And obviously, foreclosure doesn't fit that goal. And to avoid foreclosure, the lenders I represent wait 30, 60, 90 days or more after mispayment before commencing foreclosure proceedings, and during this time a lender regularly attempts to contact a borrower to go over possible options to avoid foreclosure, and that's the main reason we oppose this legislation. We've heard repeatedly over the last year and a half that the reason we need this legislation is that borrowers cannot communicate with their lender. Traditional community banks have not been mentioned in that regard. At those banks you can find someone to negotiate with. They don't lose your documents. So they haven't been cited as the problem. And beyond that, we passed a very cutting-edge law in Minnesota in 2008, the pre-foreclosure counseling notice law that requires a lender to share a customer's information with a certified counseling agency and also send a notice to the borrower saying you have the right to counseling. That law has been in effect for a year and a half, and it's working. It's helped thousands of people. Thousands of people have been counseled in Minnesota due to that law, and it's working. The bottom line is that we believe the scope of this legislation should be narrowed and just narrow the funnel that folks that would be allowed to receive the mediation provisions of the bill. This is another couple quick points, and just to wrap up, some of our members have raised concerns that the Attorney General would serve as the gatekeeper of this program. The Attorney General is a strong advocate for consumers in Minnesota, no question about that. But it may seem less than a neutral party when choosing mediators for this program. We also have concerns about the new fee, but I know that's probably not for this committee's discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, I was visiting with someone the other day that's lost their job, and they are having trouble with their house payments right now. And they contacted their local banker, and they had, did the feds just pass something? They had about 10 different avenues to go to help these people until the person got a job, because one was they could wait, make no payments for 3 months, and there was one where they would knock the interest rate down. Isn't this stuff already going on right now?
Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, there are a lot of programs both at the state and the federal level, and the one they're probably citing is the HAMP, the Making Home Affordable Modification Program, and that has kind of been dubbed the Obama program, and that was put in place last March, so about a year ago, and it got kind of off to a slow start, and a lot of people are kind of saying, well, what's going on with that program? But in the last couple months, that's really kicked into place, and it does allow a lot of folks that are able to work with their lender and the government, frankly, to do some modifications, lower their interest rates, make the changes to the payments. And I believe the current number, the Treasury has a number to keep track of it every month. I think over 1.3 million people have been served by that program. But it's really kicked into place over the last December, January, and early February period.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Johnson, I think another provision was to extend the length of the loan so the payments could go down a bit. But so if that's in place already, all these programs are in place, why do we need this?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Davids, I question the need for this legislation, too. As you mentioned, there are a lot of state, a lot of federal, a lot of state programs going on. As I mentioned earlier, the prevention counseling that the state kicked in 2008, it's the first in the country, and I don't know if any other state that's done that. They're helping thousands of borrowers, too. People are eligible for that counseling. I wonder if there is a need for legislation, Mr.
Well,
Davids.
And Mr. Chairman, a quick question for Representative Dabney. I was just looking through some things here, and I believe, and I know, please don't tell Representative Liebling that I'm going to ask this question, but didn't the governor veto this bill last year? And I know we can't bring that into the debate, but if we had a governor that was going to veto and already did, why?
You're out of order.
I've always wanted to do that. That's the first time I've ever done it.
I used to do it all the time.
Let's do it more. Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, the goal, without putting words in her mouth, I know that the goal of the author is to put on the governor's desk a bill that he will sign.
Thank you.
Representative Dabney. Any other questions? I'm sorry. I'm so thrilled to have done that.
You want to do it again?
Any other questions,
Mr. Chair?
If not, we've got Mr. Skilbred that's got some testimony for us as well. Welcome back, Mr. Skilbred. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David Skilbred with the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. Considering that I'm going to also have to say that I oppose the bill, I'm wondering, can I take the bar exam?
Rather than testify here today?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much for being here. I want to applaud also Representative Dabney, Representative Mullery, and the Attorney General's Office for the work we've done the last 3 years on these issues, and also for putting before you today a bill that is much improved and stronger than it was at the beginning of the last session. Despite that, though, I have to also say that we do not support the bill. And I'll just take off a few points very closely. Number one, the aim of the bill is to provide a process through which homeowners facing foreclosure can have an audience with their lender. I think you know community bankers themselves, you know these institutions. If you think of a community bank that you have worked with, I know that you will conclude that you can walk through the door, walk in and talk with the staff, and those folks are available, and therefore I do not think they are the problem that this bill is trying to solve. I think that the bill is really aimed at the absent lenders, the 1-800 numbers, the lenders that you just can't get a hold of, and that's where the frustration is among borrowers that are trying to talk to somebody in charge who can work with them, and they can't find anybody. We understand that frustration, but we don't think that our lenders are the ones that are causing that. Secondly, I had Housing Link put together a little graph here. I'm hesitant to hand it out because my mother always told me that if I don't have enough to share with everybody, not to use it, you know. But I've got some here, and I think what this shows, I'll hold it up at least, you can see it. This represents 1,668 foreclosures in 2009 in Hennepin County in Ramsey County. 78 lenders foreclosed on those properties. Of those 1,668, 6% or 100 foreclosures were made by community banks or savings associations. 5% or 81 foreclosures were made by entities like the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, Habitat for Humanity, or small credit unions. 89% or 48 lenders were responsible for 1,487 foreclosures, and those were a combination of national banks or national servicing companies or national credit unions. And I think what this shows is that the community bankers are a small piece of the pie when it comes to mortgages initiated, held, and serviced. Number three, we want to thank the authors for the community bank exemption in Article 1, Section 6, Sub 5, which exempts you if you have five foreclosures or less and then qualify for a few other things. We appreciate the spirit of this, but I want to just put this story in your mind. Imagine that you are in a small rural town, and one of the major lenders, because of this economic challenge that we face today, and decides to close. Let's say they have 10, 20 employees. It's very possible that five of those could have a mortgage with their local bank. And not because of any product the bank sold, or not because of any activity or service that the bank did or did not provide, that bank now might be subject to this exemption because of something totally out of their control. So we appreciate the amendment. We'd like to see it a little bit broader. Finally, this is fashioned after the Farmer Lender Mediation Act, started in 1986 and extended 13 times, I think, since then. That act is managed by the University of Minnesota Extension Service and not the Attorney General's office. So likewise, we feel that if this is made into law, some entity such like that would be a better choice. We also, we hope that if this does become law, that it is successful. And I just want to compare one thing. The Extension Service provided a document to the Ag Committee a little while ago. It showed that in 2009, there are 3,107 mediation notices filed that affected the Farmer Lender Mediation Act. Of those 3,107 mediation notices filed, 422 reached a resolution through mediation. That's a success rate of 13.5%. And farmers do not have a counseling option as homeowners do. And according to the Minnesota Home Ownership Center, in 2008, according to the report, their success rate was about 56%. So we supported that bill along with many of the others, all of the others almost, that Representative Dabney and Mullery and others have worked on. And we think that the counseling is a good alternative and it's working. We understand the desire to do this bill, but we still think that the scope is a little bit too broad. with that, I'll conclude and call for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Skilbred. We appreciate your testimony. Are there questions for Mr. Skilbred? Is there anyone else that desires to testify with respect to the bill? Other comments or questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney, I'm just curious, on the fee side of things, has there been a fiscal note that's been done on this bill at all? And how does all the fee structure work? What is it all going to cover? Are we hiring new staff for the AG's office? How does that all go throughout?
I'm going to ask Mr. Frickte to come up and speak to that. I was not involved in the setting of the fee structure. So.
And Mr. Frickte, briefly to that, because that's actually within the purview of another committee, but go on.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, there was a fiscal note done last year. I do not believe the updated one has been prepared. The AG's office will not be hiring any employees. The funds raised will be administered by the Housing Finance Agency, and if there are more mediations than money, there just won't be any more mediations. That's it. And if there, so the amount of money that's raised by the filings, that's all the money that will be available. And if there is a surplus in the account when the bill sunsets, then that money gets returned to the general fund.
Okay. Thank
Representative
you,
Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Frickte, do we have any guesstimates of how much it's going to raise? And, and is it possible for you to shoot that old fiscal note or the updated one to us, too?
Mr. Frickte.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, if based on... I think the fiscal note last year was based on somewhere between 25 and 30,000 foreclosures, and at $125 per foreclosure, that's how it all was calculated.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Any other questions? I see we've got one other person that wanted to testify, Ms. Lee. And I do want to wrap the bill up and take a vote by about 5:05. So, Ms. Lee, that's about 2 minutes. I hope that...
Okay. I'll be real quick, Mr. Great. Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International R&R Family Centers. I wanted to speak in favor of this bill. There were some issues still related to the counseling aspect of it, but I think they can be overcome. But the issue more so is how important this legislation is. One of the counseling or the agencies that certifies counselors is the NeighborWorks America, which was created by Congress. On the board sits the assistant HUD secretary appointed by President Obama and the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve appointed by Chairman Ben Bernanke. So they are interested as far as resolutions to these issues regarding foreclosure, the involvement of counselors. But speaking to the issue about counseling being successful, the 56% that was spoken of was the numbers had been before. The 56% of 8,000 was per 2008 figures, and when it worked down to how many were actually successful, I'm a former corporate auditor and controller. I also have real estate and banking background, so that really worked out to a 4% success rate, and success was considered, well, you might have to put your home up for sale. There are limitations as to what counselors can do. A lot of cases, really, you need the attorneys in there and the financial people who know how to do the financial numbers to make it work, not just putting a late payment on the back end, which they can do anyway, and count that as success. So there are a lot of situations where it does take the legal knowledge and the financial knowledge to really put things together, and that's not what the counselors are all trained to do. So we do need these... mediators in there, and there's a lot of situations where they are needed. So, thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Lee. Unless there's other questions, Chair Dabney renews his motion that House File 2613 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next up is House File 170. Representative Gardner, the Chair will move. I'm sorry, this came out of Representative Johnson's committee, right? So Representative Johnson will move adoption of the committee report with respect to House File 170. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Johnson will move that House File 170 as amended by the division be recommended pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Gardner, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this bill has changed since it was first introduced, House File 170. Cuts government regulation to the private sector.
How come you're looking at the Republican
side? I don't know. I didn't say anything. Mr. Chair, I've been looking at the issue that a lot of consumers are upset about, which is they're getting a lot of unsolicited telephone directories, mostly Yellow Pages. The original bill said that the telephone publishers, directory publishers, would have to have an opt-out system so you can go to a website or an 800 number and say, I don't want a phone book anymore, and it would take you off. That was controversial. The Yellow Pages Association was opposed, and it's turned out that they actually have a pretty robust opt-out system now. So you could go to any of the Yellow Pages providers in Minnesota and find a place to be able to not get a Yellow Pages. What you have before you, though, is now all about White Pages. The one consensus we found among consumer advocates who want less waste and the Yellow Pages folks is that we actually have state rules that say you must be given a residential directory by your local service provider. And so this bill just asks the PUC to delete those three rules. So if a telephone service provider wants to just keep sending you a book and you're fine with that, that's fine. If they want to do an opt-out system where they send it out to everybody and then you can go call them or email them and say, I don't want a White Pages anymore, you could do that. You could do an opt-in system where the provider says, we're not going to send anyone a directory unless they want one. And they would have to notify that person, and they would be required to deliver a directory if a customer wants one. So that's all the bill says. It's just about White Pages, and that's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gardner.
I should say the Yellow Pages Association is neutral, and they said they're neutral because it doesn't deal with Yellow Pages anymore. So,
is there Representative Ansel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, people in the woods cut the trees that go to the paper mill to make the paper. Then the paper goes to the printer to print the yellow and the white pages. So I imagine it could be a little bit of a stretch, but there could be a jobs problem with this legislation. How large? Who knows? But my real question is, how does a person living in the woods without the comforts of computers and internet and so on and so forth, how does that person preemptively tell the telephone provider, don't send me a book?
Representative Gardner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ansels, that's currently with the Yellow Pages. That person would have a number they can call that's in the directory. As it relates to the White Pages, the folks at Quest, anyway, have told me that it is in their financial best interest to make sure that their customers know what their options are because they don't want to get a lot of complaint calls because it costs them money. So it would be in their best interest to notify consumers that here's what we're going to do. We either will give you a chance to opt out, or we'll give you we'll send you a postcard, or we'll put something in your bill that says, if you want a Yellow Pages, here's where you go, and we're not going to send you one anymore. The bill just deletes those rules that require the delivery, so they can work out a deal with however the provider and the customer want to work it out. But as it relates to the forest products industry, I guess, Representative Ansels, I know you'll have to vote your conscience. There will be somebody here from the printing industry you're talking to.
Why don't we take the testifiers, and then we'll see what questions we have. I believe there's somebody that wanted to be heard. Good afternoon. Welcome.
How are you doing? Good afternoon, Chairman, Mr. Chairman.
On the Yellow Pages.
Who is she?
Yellow Pages Association.
practice the yellow.
She should wear yellow.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the Commerce Committee. My name is David Raji. I am the current president and CEO of the printing industry of Minnesota. And as a trade association representing the printing manufacturers across the state of Minnesota and North Dakota, over 28,000 individuals work in Minnesota in the print industry today, producing about $6 billion worth of product. I'm here participating in the legislative process with concerns on House File 170. This bill indicates a lack of understanding of both the printed and wood products industry playing a major part in our state's economy. It also fails to recognize the important way people receive information, the traditional telephone directory. As some of you may be aware, and not everyone has a computer, and not everyone has access to the internet. Telephone directories are a method of information that are comfortable with many of our citizens in Minnesota. In addition, advertisers pay for the insertions that deliver these white pages to individuals in our communities. The producers of the telephone directory sell the advertisement, which creates a lot of different kinds of jobs in the state of Minnesota. Our concern in my organization is the idea that trees are being unnecessarily wasted in the production of telephone books. Trees are a crop. We cut them down because we plant five of them for every one that we actually cut down. And it's a resource that is very renewable. With vegetable inks and trees, this is a very green product. And I think some information was delivered to each of you about how green printing is. And it's a renewable resource and renewable jobs for the state of Minnesota. I also have a letter here from one of my members. On a short notice, I asked one of them who does print directories to make some comments, and this letter is from Dennis Hall. I believe also it was sent to you or delivered to you today. From Forum Communications, our company, Forum Communications, has been printing telephone directories for many years. It has been a very important aspect of our printing business. We have two printing facilities that employ over 200 people. Telephone directory printing, binding, and mailing is done with both facilities. The telephone directories are printed on our cold set web presses as well and on our sheet fed presses. They are bound on perfect binding equipment and then go through the mailing departments for addressing and mailing. The process involves large number of our employees. Should legislation be passed that would have negative impact on the printing of telephone directories, that negative impact would affect our printing company and the people who work here as well. We annually realize from $650,000 to $1 million in telephone directory revenue. It is an amount that would be nearly impossible to replace in a short-term time frame. With that type of loss, we would likely have employee layoffs. It would reduce our ability to reinvest in capital equipment and other areas needed to grow our business. While Forum Communication Printing would have major losses should such legislation be acted, we would hope that the job loss and economic impact on many companies who publish telephone directories is being taken into consideration. With the state's economy and the extremely high unemployment rates, the impact of this legislation would truly be devastating to these companies, their employees, and the communities in which they are located. It is for reasons mentioned above, we have strongly urged you to vote against any legislation that will have negative impact on the printing and distribution of telephone directories. Thank you in advance for your consideration and for listening to our concerns. Sincerely, Dennis Hall, Vice President of Commercial Printing, Forum Communications Printing. With that, Mr. Chair, thank you, and members of the committee, any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Raji. Are there any questions for Mr. Raji at this time? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there others that desire to be heard with respect to the bill? Members, questions or concerns? Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gardner, as I read this right now, and maybe I'm missing something, but if I look on line 1.9 where it says, after the comma, it says, unless a customer requests delivery of a directory, am I looking at that right in that right now a phone company would not have to deliver any directories to anybody, any white pages, unless somebody specifically asked for one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, that is one possible outcome. Another one is that a phone service provider could say, we just like how we're doing it now because our customers like it that way, and we'll just leave it. And actually, thanks to the PUC for having that part after the comma, because they said, yeah, we want to make sure somebody gets a directory if they really want it.
Representative Hoppe? Others with questions or concerns? Representative Mueller?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Gardner, I have major concern with this. A lot of people in my district, maybe the suburbs, everybody has a computer in every room by a telephone. In my district, a lot of people don't have computers. And it's been extremely traditional that DFLers protected against opt-in provisions. And so I think that this bill is absolutely, I just can't imagine having an opt-in provision in this. If you want to change it to an opt-out provision, but you're leaving it up to the local people, and I'm not that reliant on their marketing ideas right now for the future of people in my district that need phone books. And so I would hope very much that if this passes out today that you change it and make sure that there is an opt-out provision, not an opt-in, that an opt-out is required or else they get this phone book.
Representative Gardner, you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, honestly, we've been all over the map on the issue with some of the publishers, and this is actually the one that offers consumers the best choice just for the residential directory. There's an opt-out system right now for the yellow pages, and again, nobody who wants a white pages would be refused one under the bill.
Just so we're clear right now, if I to follow up on Representative Mullery's question, if I were to contact my phone company now and say, I don't want the white pages anymore, under current law, they'd still have to send me one. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that would be correct. They'd have to comply with Minnesota rules.
Right. Have you considered the idea of making it at least, you know, as an interim move? This is just a question. I'm not necessarily suggesting it as an amendment per se, but that to start it with the process of that if the customer calls and says, I don't want to receive it anymore, that they would have that right.
That would be an opt-out, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, yes. I know.
Well, if
I think that's what he just said. Yeah, I'm just asking.
Mr. Chair, I'm not opposed to the idea, but I, you know, leave it up to the body. I mean, it's not moving in the Senate yet, too. I can certainly talk with the Senate author. I mean, if it was opt-out, it would be consistent with what the voluntary system is for the yellow pages. But somehow we'd have to get rid of the rule. I mean, we could have the rule change in here still and then add something that says the provider has to provide an opt-out.
Yeah, it's actually very simple if you wanted to do it. I'm just curious if the and, you know, this is sort of non-traditional, but this committee, Chairman Davids, has always been non-traditional, right? Who would prefer an opt-out? Just by a show of hands. Who likes it as an opt-in?
Maybe
you don't like either.
Well, then you don't get to vote, do you? Who likes it as an opt-in?
I'm on board again.
So my sense is that it, you know, there's folks are sort of torn one way or the other. But I think what I would suggest that we do, you've obviously, and Representative Mulray, I'll come to you in just a moment, okay. But what I'd suggest that you do is see what's shaking in the Senate. There seems to be on both sides of the table some reservations about the current approach. I think possibly as a step in between here, where, you know, current law where you have to get a directory whether you want one or not, and your proposal here, which is that you've got to literally contact them and say you need it, is you know, my sense is maybe we pass the bill out the way it is today, but that you consider especially in light of if it's not moving in the Senate, that you may want to discuss with them possibly doing it as an opt out rather than opt in.
Mr. Chair, I can't recall where we're sending it next. I want to say, if it's a general register, maybe I could just suggest that maybe you want to hold it over, mm-hmm. so we don't have to change something on the floor. I'd really rather not do that.
Oh, it's fun changing stuff. Representative Gardner. Why don't if folks are comfortable doing that, maybe that's then we'll see how things shake out in the Senate a little bit, and you can keep plugging away at it. I think you have a good sense though where the. And my guess is that this body is this committee is usually pretty reflective of what you'll face on the floor as well. That's usually my gut is whatever you're getting from the folks here you'll usually face on the House floor. With that, the chair will then lay over House File 170. Thank you, Representative Gardner, and thank you, Mr. Raji, for your testimony. And next up, Representative Begum has House File 2879. The chair will move that House File 2879 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Begum, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In 4 years, this is my first time that I've been in your committee. And, you know, one of the elders of the body mentioned to me that some of the most dangerous bills are the shortest bills, and I kind of resented having both of those words in the same sentence.
Yeah, it's actually...
thank you. Thank you, Jill, for getting that into... Thanks. All right, on to the bill. I do have an oral amendment, Mr. Chair. On line 1.7, if we could delete 2. And then on 1.8, delete everything and then move the period to the last word, which would be insurance on line 0.17. So I'm just deleting to the same extent as an adult.
All right, the chair will move the oral amendment. Is everybody clear on the amendment? Seeing no reservations about it, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Begum, then to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a very simple bill. Right now, under current law, a minor is authorized to own a car or an automobile legally at the age of 17. Well, they couldn't get insurance for it. So we're just clarifying that you are able to receive a insurance policy for your car that you're legally able to own. It's pretty simple. Senator Sieben and I had a constituent where it was the case that they owned a car and the parents, that the kid wanted to have the own policy and they weren't able to do it, and so they got clarification and they kind of found the loophole. And so I've worked with the folks in the insurance industry, and there's peace in the valley.
So Representative Begum, then, if this passes, can I tell my 16-year-old that he has to buy his own insurance then?
Could.
He's legally required? All right, good. Yes. Representative David?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a question for Mr. Pender on line 1.6, where it says automobile or truck under section 168.101. What is the definition of a truck? Under 160, would it be under 8,000 gross vehicle weight, or what are we talking?
Mr. Pender?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, I'm going to have to look that up.
Okay.
And while he's doing that, are there other questions, Representative Hoppe? And we'll come back, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Begum, I did a little bit of looking, and I didn't find it. Is there anything in current state statute that says that a company can't sell, so it's not illegal?
No.
Representative Begum?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, that's a good question. It's kind of not really spoken. It's like they can do it, but they can't do it, but nothing prohibits them from not doing it. It's just that it's really unclear, and so all we're saying right now is you can do it.
Now,
we're not forcing them to do anything.
I was just going to ask that follow-up question. Insurers are not required to sell to a minor. They just can under your proposal. I'm sorry, Representative Hoppe.
No, absolutely not, Mr. Chair. And I do believe there is a Mr. Doug Franzen from PCI that wants to come in and give support to the bill, if you'll indulge him, I think. It's up to you. It's your committee, sir.
Mr. Franzen.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for your indulgence. Briefly, I represent the property. My name is Doug Franzen, and I represent the Property Casualty Insurers of America. We believe this bill makes sense. Our assumption under the language is that this permits a minor to enter into a legally binding contract. We believe that is the legislative intent, because an insurance contract has rights and obligations that flow both ways. Representative Bigham is correct. Some companies write insurance for minors, others do not. And our survey of the companies, we represent those companies who do not have concerns that the a minor cannot enter into a legally binding contract. That is the issue, and if this language, if the verbiage power to contract actually does create a mutually enforceable contract, we think it's a good idea.
Thank you, Mr. Franzen. And Mr. Bender, Representative Davids, are you all on the same page at this point?
Well, thank
literally
you,
and figuratively?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is kind of interesting because a truck means any motor vehicle designed and used for carrying things other than passengers, except pickup trucks and vans, included in the definition of passenger automobile. So a 17-year-old could buy a 2-ton grain truck, and they'd have to sell them insurance for that thing. Or a semi. No, that'd be a tractor.
Well, just so we're clear, I think what Representative Bigham said is an insurer does not have to sell anybody insurance. Is that correct, Representative Bigham?
Correct.
It just, what this proposal, and it bears reading it, I guess, it just says that that a minor would have the power to contract for that insurance, but an insurer isn't required to sell it.
Correct. Representative Davids, like the example, if Representative Hoppe or Zellers, I know they don't have kids old enough to drive yet, but when their kids...
Legally.
You have one? Okay. if Representative Hoppe didn't want his son or daughter to be on their insurance policy and they own their own car, this would allow that individual to go to insurance companies, ask to be covered, and the insurance company then could say yay or nay. It's just like an adult now. But it just allows them to have their own policy. And
well, Mr. Chairman and Representative, I don't know of any company out there that would want to insure a 17-year-old without the parents on board. I mean,
where's
the teeth in this thing? I mean, they're going to go and try and find insurance, and every insurance company in the state is going to say no thank you.
Representative Bigham or Mr. Franzen, it's my understanding that some companies actually sell to minors now.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, that is correct. Some companies do sell the policy. Again, the issue is the enforceability. The risk assumed by a company writing a minor is largely a function of the underwriting. For example, a 17-year-old would not necessarily get the same rate that you would, Representative Davids, being a good driver, a strong driver, and over 17.
Are there other questions?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and maybe to Mr. Franzen here, the definition of a truck, in my mind, for this bill, a truck would be a pickup or a van. But it excludes pickup or van, and it means a truck is something other than a pickup or van.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Davids, I can't substitute my judgment for an underwriter, but if there is a large truck that a 17-year-old or 16-year-old wants to insure, my guess is that our underwriters would say no.
And they'd still have that option under this proposal?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there other questions or concerns? If not, the Chair will renew his motion that House File 2879 be recommended to pass and as amended be referred to the General Register, or I'm sorry, to Civil Justice. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. Thank you, Representative Bigham. I notice you've stayed.
Yep.
House File 1746 is the next one up. Representative Davney moves the division report with respect to House File 1746. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Davney moves that House File 1746 is amended in the division, be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Bigham, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate all the help and assistance that both the committee chairs have helped me with this to get it into the form I want. I am going to allow my testifier, Lisa Schmidt, who also happens to be Representative Cole's constituent, and Representative Cole's had to go home with his kids, and so he was going to join me today, but he is a co-author on this bill along with Representative Smith. I'm going to let my testifier explain what happened to her, and then I will, if you would let me, go back through once she's done, and I'll explain the bill.
Sure. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I didn't bring my glasses, so bear with me. 2 years ago, our middle son, Ryan, who was 5 years old at the time, was seriously injured at an indoor inflatable party zone. He was jumping at the base of an inflatable.
Mrs. Smith, could you just do me a favor for that? There's a tape that records it. If you could just identify who you are for the
record. Lisa Schmidt from Victoria.
Thank you.
Okay. He was jumping on a 20-foot tall inflatable slide when he went over the side. He was jumping at the base, landing headfirst on commercial-grade carpeting lined directly on top of concrete. He suffered a skull fracture and a brain injury, and he has recovered, but will never know the long-lasting, long-term effects of his injury. These indoor inflatable amusement parks are all the rage, catering to young families and birthday parties where parents sign a waiver, giving up their legal rights and dropping their kids off, fully believing that their children are playing safely and being monitored by trained attendants. Often this just is not the case. Other Minnesota children have been seriously injured on these inflatable indoor amusement rides. I'm passing pictures around right now that you can take a look at. But the operations manual of the slide that my son was injured on does require a trained operator to be on duty at all times. The ASTM standards for the inflatable industry, which many states have adopted into law in its entirety, requires that one trained operator per inflatable ride and padding on the floor surround each inflatable to protect from injury. The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission published a bulletin in 2001 requiring a trained attendant for each inflatable and two for any slide over 15 feet tall. And in a report just published last year by the Consumer Product Safety Commission, there was an estimated 31,069 estimated emergency room treated injuries from 2003 to 2007. These oversized commercial inflatable rides are exactly that. They're rides. In our state, the amusement park law 184B makes no reference to inflatable amusement rides, and this growing industry is completely unregulated in our state, putting Minnesota children at serious risk. Having a trained operator on duty is absolutely essential for the safety of jumpers. In fact, a lack of a trained supervision accounts for approximately 43% of all injuries on inflatables, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics in 2009. And playing on inflatables is not the same as playing at a neighborhood or city park. However, when a child can climb or be pushed, fall, jump from any structure, there should be protection on the ground to minimize injury. Industry-created ASTM standards require protection on any landing surface surrounding any inflatable. Without laws in place to enforce the very supervision the inflatables require by the manufacturer, the ASTM industry standards and the Consumer Product Safety Commission, these inflatable party zone establishments will continue to be wild free-for-all danger zones. Parents will continue to falsely believe the industry has operated safely. Parents will continue to sign away their legal rights, leaving their children unsupervised on commercial-sized inflatables at establishments that don't carry any sort of medical insurance. While this bill does not seek to regulate the inflatable rental industry, I strongly feel that Minnesota companies in business for profit from the play of young children should be required by Minnesota law to follow the manufacturer's equipment requirements, their own industry standards, and the guidelines of the United States Consumer Product Safety Commission. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Bigham, you wanted to explain the bill a bit?
Yep. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Members, Subdivision 1 has the definitions, and I want to reiterate that this does not include places that rent out these inflatables. So if Representative Zellers wanted to have a birthday party for his kids and rent one of these in his backyard, it would not include that. I just want that to be crystal clear. Subdivision 2 talks about that. Can't provide the inflatable amusement park equipment unless you comply with this section of law. Subdivision 3 requires that we have ASTM standards for these structures. Subdivision 4 is that there's supervision for the ratio of the inflatables that structures. 5, we have insurance required. 6, there is registration with Dolly, and Dolly is also here, Mr. Chair, if there are any questions. There's a $100 registration fee, and the Dolly is the enforcer of this new policy. A couple things I'd like to say. My Senate counterpart made me aware that 35 or 34 states regulate this industry. Currently, if a child gets hurt and the parents call Dolly, they are turned away and say we don't have any jurisdiction over this industry. I believe this is a very reasonable bill to prevent injuries from making injuries worse. I would appreciate your support, and also appreciate again the work that Representative Coles and Smith have helped me on.
Thank you, Representative Bigham. Is there anyone else that desires to testify with respect to the bill? Questions or comments, concerns from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bigham, I mentioned this to you on the House floor the other day when I had questions about this bill. The city of Plymouth actually owns three inflatables that they put in their field house over the winter months. They have it open to the public for 3 days a week for 3 hours at a time. In reading this bill, I am not sure that they would not be included as part of this because they own the equipment. They are charging a fee to use it, and it's open to the public. Can you give me greater clarification if they would be under this same policy, and if they would be required to hire the staff to man each one of those inflatables within the city?
Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. I may have Dolly come down and help with that, but I'm going to take a crack at it first. My interpretation would be no, for the reason that, one, I'm assuming they already provide these standards and they're covered under their own liability insurance. So I would say no, but that's, if it is, it's not what I intend to do. So I'll let Dolly.
Well, we also have Mr. Pender right here. I think he can probably answer that without having to have anybody come down.
He's real smart.
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Anderson, on line 1.10, it says that commercial use here, which is what's covered, means regular use of an inflatable for profit. So if the city is not doing it for profit, then this, in other words, if they're just covering their costs, then this wouldn't apply to them. And if they're doing it for profit, I'd say it probably does.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if the fee that they're charging is just to cover the costs or not. I'll have to ask them in greater detail, but I just wanted to make you aware.
Absolutely. And Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, please get back to me on that, because I'd be more than happy to work with you on that. No problem.
Are there other questions, concerns from members of the committee? Okay. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bigham, in the bill, and it's the section about supervision, subdivision 4 on line 2.7. Mm-hmm. It's the thing, yeah, the ratio of supervisors to inflatables must be no less than one.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to Pump It Up once, and I was like the best one in that jumping thing.
Okay.
Just kidding. There aren't that many supervisors. There aren't that many people working there completely. And I don't know how many jumping things they have there, but if they have 6 or 7, I don't think they had more than a couple of people working in the whole place. Is that something that's open to negotiation, or is that a national standard? Is that going to put these guys out of business?
Representative Bigham.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, first, there's never an intention to put this out of business. And two, just as if you had a carnival or at Valley Fair, which I'm assuming we've all been to, there is a supervisor per ride. And so I do believe this is part of a standard, but I can let Ms. Schmidt answer, or also Ms. John, it begins with an S, I'm sorry, I forgot your last name, from Dolly. So either...
Whoever happens to know the question. Ms. Schmidt, do you happen to know?
May I speak? In 2007, Carter Justice suffered a shattered skull and brain injury at Pump It Up, mm-hmm, in Burnsville. In 2009, Andrew Fashing completely damaged his arm and required surgery and a hospital stay at Pump It Up in Eden Prairie. My son was injured at Pump It Up in Eden Prairie. 2008, Grant Rosenberger suffered a skull fracture after no attendance even witnessed, and the neurosurgeon had to piece together what happened by the testimony of 8-year-olds at the birthday party at Pump It Up. So it's the very way that they're running their business against these standards that's contributing to these injuries. These rides need to be supervised.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. Although the question, you know, no offense, but the question was, what's the standard if there happens to be one? Sir, can you help us out?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is John Schultz. I'm an assistant director with the Construction Codes and Licensing Division, the Department of Labor and Industry, and my section is charged with administering 184B. The ASTM standards do require the manufacturers of the equipment to identify the number of supervisors for each of those particular devices, and it is not less than one per. Some of them require more than one, and it's somewhat dependent again on the size and the type of those inflatable devices. Some of them, as you may be aware, are 18, 20 foot or even taller, and are very large, and would obviously require more than one supervisor. So the minimum is one. It may be more dependent on the particular design and type of a device.
Mr. Schultz, Representative Hoppe, anything further?
No more, Mr.
Any other questions or comments from members? With that, Representative Johnson, then we'll renew his motion that House File 1746 be reckoned and passed and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, members. I appreciate your help.
Last up, Representative Johnson has House File 2907, and we'll move the division report. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Johnson then moves House File 2907 as amended in the division. We recommend it pass and refer to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. Representative Johnson, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to move A4 amendment.
Representative Johnson moves the A4 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Johnson, to your bill is amended.
Let me just make clear what the A4 amendment does, just so people are aware of the change. It does three things. One thing it did was just remove the word goal from broadband advisory group. The second thing it did, and we're talking about subdivision four, the last part of the bill here, instead of identifying sectors in telecommunications, which should be represented, leaves it more open and says the commissioner shall appoint members representing suppliers and users of broadband goods and services. And the third thing it does is it says instead of meeting quarterly, the group will meet at the call of the chair. It's a little bit more flexibility there as well. So that's the amendment that was just placed on. Let me just say a few words about the background of how this bill came to be and then explain briefly what the bill does. In April of 2008, a law was passed that formed the Minnesota Ultra High Speed Broadband Task Force, and that task force met regularly, worked real hard for a year and a half to outline a path to high-speed internet access for all residents by 2015, and that was a 23-member task force, and it consisted of a variety of stakeholders in the telecom world. And after numerous meetings and listened to the public and so on, the work culminated in the Minnesota Ultra High-Speed Broadband Report, which laid out proposed actions and set goals for broadband in the state of Minnesota, and they put together a nice report. If you hadn't had a chance to look at it, it looks like this, and it is floating around, and we can get you a copy if you want a copy of it sometime. It's definitely worth reading. Now, House File 2907, which you have amended before you, is based on the work of this task force and the recommended goals and actions. There's four parts to the bill. Just briefly, they are as follows. The first part sets the goals, and there are two parts to that. Universal access, ubiquity, we call it, no later than 2015, the keyword being all state residents and businesses. And then it sets a speed goal of 10 megabits down and 5 megabits up. The second part of the bill in the subdivision 2 talks about the state broadband leadership position, and there's two parts to that. One is access or penetration in the state, and well, we want to, by 2015, rank among the top five states in the U.S. and 15 nations globally for access or penetration. Then secondly, we're looking at speed from a different perspective other than putting a concrete number on and saying that Minnesota should be within the highest rank among the top five states in the U.S. for speed of broadband. Again, it's just another way of looking at speed, because we don't know how that's going to change over the next 5 years. 10 and 5 megabits might be looked at as ridiculously slow, and this gives a more of a different way of viewing the speed issue. Third, there'll be an annual report
do that will go to the telecom committees, policy committees of the House and Senate. Again, just to kind of make sure that the goals are being achieved and they're doing we're doing what we say we're going to do. The last part is the advisory group, and essentially what this group's going to do is advise the Commissioner of Commerce and the House and Senate Telecom Policy Committees regarding strategies to best move forward to meet the goals of this universal access and speed. That, in sum, Mr. Chair and committee members, is the bill you have before you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Is there anyone that desires to testify with respect to House File 2907? Are there questions or concerns from members? Are you sure?
I'm
you didn't
sorry,
seem
Mr.
so sure.
Chair.
Representative Davids?
Just a clarification. There's a cost. Where does this bill go to next if it passes?
It goes to government operations.
Okay.
Are there other questions or concerns? All right. With that, Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 2907 be recommended pass as amended and referred to the Government Operations Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. With that, folks, we stand adjourned. We've got a meeting on Thursday. We're going to talk about gambling a little bit. We'll see you then.
All right.